around inside of me, I couldn't do it. And now, when I'm in the mushroom, I actually find myself very, although it's intellectual and it's interesting, and there are machines the size of Manitoba, I've often found it to be very vital for the heart center.
I think intent has a lot to do with it. The most moving heart experience I ever had, or in the top five anyway, was on LSD, and it completely arranged my life. And you know, I was 19 years old. I had a great deal of hostility toward my parents. I was a Marxist and of this and of that, and just tied in knots. And it undid me very dramatically, and the changes that went on that morning are all still nicely in place, thank you. So I think it has a lot to do with context and intent and what you need and how fucked up you are, you know, because any psychedelic will act psycholytically on an obsessional or a complex personality. Yeah.
Are the North American analogs less somatically challenging, do you find? Are they all, DMT and Harmala are going to make you bark anywhere?
By North American analogs, you mean Spolaris and like that? The problem is that while DMT is common throughout many plants in nature, it's rarely in very concentrated form. If you're trying to get off with Phalaris, you're going to have a lot of it. People seem to be having a lot of luck with Mimosa hostilis and the conspecific Mexican species. Secotria viridis remains the best source for DMT. Most DMT in the underground is synthesized. It's not plant extracted anyway.
We brought up children a couple of times. I'm just wondering if you have anything to say on the postmodern child. You know, I had an experience of going to see, I hate to say it, Spice World. But it had so many postmodern self-referential plays within it, and I couldn't follow the movie, and 7-year-old kids could.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, Mark Spice. I think that what you're making is a reasonable observation. It's probably getting off easy. In the fact that the environment the 7-year-olds are growing up in is so overcoded, right? There's so much flowing in so many different directions that they've probably, their brain stems are probably literally different from ours. I mean, I hate to think that at 35 I can't get with it in the context of modern culture, but in some ways...
What an admission. Put that next to your name on the cover of Wired.
There you go. Yeah.
Right.
Now, Wired is written for rich 45-year-olds. But Spice World was probably designed for their target audience, which are like 10-year-olds. And so it's literally built with that kind of, it's almost a catalytically, you know, sort of self-referential engine in it. Because that's what's going to hold their attention. That's what's going to be... Yeah, I mean, it's if movies are hypnotic forms of media, which they really are, then it takes a different type of beast to hypnotize a 10-year-old. Just the same way, I mean, I went to see Armageddon, for example, and no single shot in Armageddon is more than 2 seconds long. I'm starting to get an epileptic seizure after 45 minutes of this film. I think it really represents what they're doing is they're doing whatever they can to hold the attention, to maintain the sort of the hypnotic illusion of the film. And the requirements for that are different for a 7 or 10-year-old because they're growing up in this environment which has caused them to really form differently in their psychic processes. What will be interesting is to see these kids when they get to 18 and 20 and start, you know, passing through the university system and whatnot, and find out what holds their attention then.
Because of what I do, I'm in the media stream. Like, my personal media stream is like a really good 15-year-olds. And, you know, what happens is they just become creators, like, that much earlier, that much younger. I mean, they're the ones with the families, they're the ones with the websites. They're, you know, and it's very dense, well thought out, well put together, like, quality art direction.
Will they be able to talk to us, or will they only be able to talk to each other? Will I be able to talk to them?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you have to just try. You have to just jump into that culture and see.
Okay, so can I ask a question for Terrence then?
Sure.
If we, and I think it's probably reasonable to say, we probably don't want to necessarily get left behind by this, what can we look to? Is there either a drug or a ritual that can help us grow into where our kids may already be?
No, you know, I think we have to have character models built of ourselves and turn the whole thing over into our writers. And we'll just go off to Tahiti, and the writers can... It's the Uncle Duke solution. If you can turn yourself into a cartoon character, you can retire, and a whole team of people will keep you au courant. This is Finn's plan for me, by the way. Says, you know, I think the only way to keep your career going is to retire the bod and create an online character. Saturday morning cartoon show, apparently, is where the action is. And then there are the Teletubbies.
Yes.
And, you know, they take a further leap. The 15-year-old girls we're talking about can't understand the logic of the Teletubby world. How much more obscure, then, is it to us? And then what do the Teletubby addicts portend? They have TV sets in their stomachs. They exist in a world where the sun of LSD seems to shine all day
long.
And everybody's pre-verbal. How's that for an archaic revival?
So those are actually the Teletubby kids, what is it, 1 to 3 year olds?
1 to 3.
The audience will be the 13-year-olds in 2012.
That's right. Yeah. The child is father to the man. Yeah.
Kind of two things. One, I don't expect an answer from, but could our parents talk to us when we were 13? Not mine. And I don't think that was too different from some of the people that I've seen about. So I don't know about that part, and I don't have children, so I can't speak as a child anymore. But my first question about the multiple personas, and was this a desirable thing, I did get interrupted before I could get to where I wanted to be by all your faithful defenders. All the points were very good, and I was curious to hear what people were going to say to that. But really, isn't the underlying connector to the whole thing what you started talking about, what we did this morning, the opening of the heart connection? So in the point that you've made, and a couple of the other people, about how we won't be able to talk to kids because we won't be from that generation that's happening right now, don't you talk to people through the heart? So if there are multiple personalities,
right,
and that's, I don't care to judge if it's a good or bad thing, but say we have 4 or 5 online characters. One is the kind of demonic edge and sort of attractive violence, which I don't know, because I don't really tend to go that way. But of all the different personalities that we could develop and explore, isn't the real thing, and I heard you start to get close to it, and that's what I was kind of leading for you to pick up the pace with, was, is there going to be an ethics
right.
that we have to impart onto our children so that they can make their own decisions
exactly.
in the future. And aren't these kids already making this decision, the statement
right.
said that, geez, you know, the kids already know the truth, we're the ones who are screwed up. But which ethics for which persona mm-hmm. is going to be appropriate? Who is going to teach or impart that information towards those ethics?
Right.
So is one persona going to be where, well, my value system really isn't towards honesty? Okay, another person over here may have that, and that's not better or worse than mine. Is this other persona of mine going to be, my whole integrity is based upon honesty? So do we have multiple ethics for multiple personalities? And aren't we already crowded enough in the United States and the world that we're going to have each person with 10 more persons?
Okay. I want, you're dead on. Ideally, we want to be able to talk to our children so we can transmit values. Some of that's done through language, but I think the largest part of it is done through example. Because that speaks in a language that isn't bounded by rhetoric, and it isn't subject in most normal situations to quote-unquote poison, because it's authentic. And authenticity seems to carry something of its own, or can carry something of its own. What was the rest of what you said? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot there. Though.
Well,
oh, multiple ethics.
Characteristics and acts and clothes that we have with each individual setting, like I may be a different person at work than I am
right.
in the sport that I like to do, or in the friends I hang around with,
right.
people who I know who like to read, I like to talk about read, or right. people I know in the music world, I like to talk music. But my more maturing that I've noticed in myself in the last years is to try and integrate all those things,
right.
not keep them separate and develop them individually. But to try and be the same person I am at work as I am at home, as I am in my sport, as I am in my music and my passions.
Probably this is a mistake, I would think. Probably this is a mistake.
Balancing?
Integrating like that. I mean, I grapple with this same thing, and then if you can't do it, you define yourself as odd, where maybe the postmodern condition is actually to admit that the industrial environment is so different from the home, the learning environment is so different from either of those, that it's, you're beating yourself on the head with some kind of print-created ethic of wholeness that is, you know, like trying to avoid venial sin or something. It just can't be done. On the question of ethics, I think, you know, nothing we've talked about here has implied that the law of karma is canceled in
That's
virtual
right.
reality.
That's right.
People who choose to be jerks will have the lives that the universe hands to jerks. And
that's a chaos.
Well, my experience is that you want to sort of streamline your being to move through society and business and love and disappointment and triumph with a certain amount of grace. Maybe the idea of personality needs to be, in the same way that we talk about transcending culture and building a metaculture, maybe the concept of personality needs to give way to something like the metanality. Mm-hmm. And the metanality is the troop of people that come and go from your body and your terminal, and for which you are responsible for the credit cards issued to them and,
right.
and so forth and so on. I mean, that could become the definition of personality. Those people for whom you have financial responsibility and direct legal accountability.
To come back to, I invoked Gurdjieff earlier, and Gurdjieff looked at this field, this army of eyes, and said that with very careful, strenuous self-observation and work, you could at least see them coming and going. And once you could see them coming and going, you could perhaps make some, what he called a permanent magnetic center out of them. Okay, so you might, if you were really good at it, and Gurdjieffians are known as being a dour lot because they practice so much self-analysis. But you could conceivably pull this into an integrated personality, which can give you a lot of flexibility. See, that's the thing it grants you in the end, is once you've got this unity, you gain an enormous amount of flexibility as a result. Mm-hmm. So it's almost as if you take the ascetic path to integrate, and you do that, what you're getting is this ability to be multiple.
Mm-hmm. But with that central core.
With that central mm-hmm. core.
People have been created personality in the media. One of the groups of people who has one of the most well-created and financially remunerated personalities, media personalities, is rappers. O'Shea Jackson is not Ice Cube. Percy Miller is not Master P. Yet, especially teenagers are the most attracted to this whole world than almost anything else. And I think to them it does represent kind of almost a karmic legendary good guys, bad guys, fighting, you know, winning, taking over, getting paid.
Is it mythic?
It's
mythic.
But when you talk about that, that's not their real personalities, that's not Ice Cube's personality. I mean, what he lives in, like, Wayna Park, and, like, you know, drives in every day.
Not to him.
But what's more important?
Well,
is it important for the...
It's crazy making to become your myth.
Yeah.
You know, Gibson's meditation on this is the novel Idoru, which is well worth reading if you're interested in the mechanics of modern celebrity. But anybody who is involved in celebrityhood has to be cynical and ironic or completely foolish, because it's so totally and obviously manipulated in front of you. I mean, you know, buy yourself a publicist and pay them $1,500 a month, and you'll be amazed at what happens to your life. You'll be a household word. We buy and sell celebrity by the pound these days. It's don't be fooled. I remember once I had a girlfriend whose father was a public relations guy. This was many, many years ago, and one evening we were waiting for the 11 o'clock news to come on, and he said, I got the circus on tonight. The circus is in town. Sure enough, the news comes on, and it's telling us that the circus is in town, and I'm sitting there thinking, my God, the fact that the circus is in town is not news. It's a commercial event. This guy just paid for this, and I stayed up to watch an infomercial on the circuit. So I think we have to assume that celebrity, we need a certain number of them. Pray you don't ever become one, and don't take it seriously. It's for...
Kids have bought into the myth that these people present, but they actually, I think, have taken away from it that it's, you know, there's like less gang activity. They take away from it that it is a story, and you can watch it be played out, and you don't have to. I mean, there's always going to be the, you know, psychotic attractor that goes to the, you know, to the nth degree of that. But that really, I think that because we've been able to play out the myths. You know, say get a life or what have you. It's allowed people to work through those things and to come, you know, to discuss them and see the consequences of them. And I move away from it.
I think what we're dancing around here is what you were hitting on, it was the ethic and the point of the ethic. And I think, you know, it's you come to a point in time when you just have to drop any illusions of the sanctity of your ethic. Because, you know, I mean, there's a period of time in this particular physical part of the world where it was ethical to beat Indians to death with sticks if they would not worship at your cross.
Of a certain culture.
It was ethical in the northern circles to kill baby girl children.
It was ethical.
And the thing is that I think because we've become such an intellectually overbearing type of being in this particular time, we become enamored of our ethic, and we think it's the only ethic to have.
Right.
And what I'm trying to say, and I think that what we're saying is, at the end of history, there is a new ethic dawning, and it's going to arrive. It's going to emerge. It's emerging. We see it emerging right in front of us, and because we come out of a series and set of ethics that were different, that's very, very different from what's dawning. Even though, you know, may have had problems with understanding our parents and children from this last era, this last epoch of ethic, you know, there was things that held them together. There were commonalities. There was wisdom to be passed through to children, even if it didn't seem like they were getting at the point. I really wonder if there's how much we have to give to inform the ethic that's building now. I think I really think that we're a footnote on it. I really think nothing more than a footnote on it. That's my personal belief, and I don't expect anybody else. No.
What I hear you saying is, it is not about rock and roll.
No.
That's get over it.
Yes.
What strikes me in this is how little attention is really paid to emotions. And Terrence, you've been very eloquent at talking about how we haven't really languaged and examined that incredibly complex, subtle dynamic that's taking place inside of us all the time, which is the emotional realm, which is ultimately what really drives us.
Right.
And yet it's this mysterious realm that we're very unfamiliar with, and the more things take place out here, the more reactive we are inside, and yet it's uncharted territory.
Can I take this for a second?
Yeah.
One of the things we'll do tonight with the Voce is the Voce is a very emotional technique for communication. It's not particularly, it's not bounded by language particularly, but it's an emotional technique for communication. And I hope we haven't been leaving the emotions out in this, or to give the impression.
I didn't mean necessarily here, I just mean in this realm that is going on.
And I think that what that calls for is an exploration of those techniques. And so what we want to do is start exploring tonight, or expose you to something that's an exploration of that. And to dedicate our work, insofar as our work is driven by our heart, to an exploration of those techniques.
So are we going to have a big trackball so we can zoom in any part of our sites? Let the earth take care of
it. Imagine it and it's yours.
Yeah.
Okay.
This thing about emotion without language is inchoate. And so the very fact that what we're talking about here is the evolution of communication carries with it the implication of an evolution of communication. I see it already happening. Our whole sociological experience has been that of breaking down the simplistic models of what it was to be a human being we inherited from our parents in the past. And we're learning more and more about who we are. You know, we're learning about the real textured feel of racial and class differences, the real texture and feel of different gender choices and sexual preferences. This is a vast frontier. We haven't even begun to fully acknowledge the complexity of our individuality and how many different kinds of us there are. But we have to have language. Without language, it's just a kind of a leading edge of intuition that doesn't cast light very far into the future. With language, our diversity becomes this thing that is a great source of community and individual satisfaction. And so the whole project is the project of communication. And then the understanding, the heart, the community, the connectivity will just be found to have followed along with the process. It's part and parcel of it. It's strange, you know, the net is denounced as austere, the product of the engineering mentality, so forth and so on. It's the most feminine influence that Western civilization has ever allowed itself to fall under the spell of. The troubadours of the 14th century were as nothing compared to the boundary-dissolving, feminizing, permitting, nurturing nature of the net. Maybe that's why there are is an overwhelming male preference for it in its early form, because that's where that was needed. But it is Sophia. It is wisdom. It is the penetrating archetypal female logos of the world soul, and leading us away from what was very sharp-edged and uncomfortable and repressive to our creativity and our sexuality and our relationships to each other and to the earth. And this is where we find ourselves at noon. This was the morning session. I hope you've planned bathing and massages and so forth and so on. We'll meet here 4 to 6. Thank you very much.
Come along to the fact that I'm still working on my vision for developing some form of networked visualization over the internet, which I'd been working on for a number of years at that point, which would allow me to perhaps continue this evocation of the planet that I felt like I was really working toward. And I subscribe to a number of mailing lists. And in a mailing list that I subscribe to, a rather good one called Fringeware, I started to see these curious little things pop up in my email. I didn't really know what they were. People seemed to be calling them URLs. And they had a very curious form. http://gobbledygook. Didn't really know what it was. Fortunately, I had a workstation, not a PC, but an actual Sun workstation on my desk that I'd recently bought and retrofitted. And I had an internet connection. And so I figured out that these artifacts were something, part of something called the World Wide Web. And I used the internet to go over to a site in Illinois where they were keeping what they were calling a web server and a web browser under the name of Mosaic. And I downloaded them to my computer and installed them and took a look at the configuration instructions, which were pretty easy, and whammo, my computer became web server number 330. And, well, I was like, okay, but what is this web thing? And I launched the Mosaic browser. It comes up on a page, and we're all familiar with the metaphors now, that pointed to the web server at NCSA, the National Center for Computer Applications. And I went click, and bam, I was somewhere else. And instantly, I got what was going on. Because I'd spent some years earlier working on a problem called hypertext. And hypertext is the concept that words and ideas are linked implicitly as well as explicitly, so that any thought that's ever been had has relations and correlations to other thoughts. And the dream and the vision behind hypertext is to be able to make those links explicit rather than implicit, so that all documents become multiple documents. There's no such thing as an isolated fragment of text anymore. It's all one big, giant, gorgeous, heterogeneous unity. Well, it was pretty much over. I had a shit-eating grin on my face for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, I was consulting, and I would get home from work, and I would fire up the Spark Station and fire up the internet link, and I would surf the web. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I was done. And it's not because I'm a fast reader. It's just that's what was there. But I could tell. I saw it, and I said, this is the shit. And I ran to my friend Owen over there, and I said, Owen, there's this web thing. It's the shit. And I dragged him over to the Spark Station, and I showed him. He's like, eh, whatever, what I've seen better. It's whatever. And I ran and tell my other friends, it's the shit. Oh, I think maybe I've heard of it. And finally, after probably enough browbeating and then maybe meditating on it, I remember that Owen and I were on a Saturday afternoon in San Francisco somewhere, and he just sort of stopped short in the middle of the street and went, it is the shit. This is going to be it. This is big. Because the vision of a global hypertext system had seduced a certain segment of people who were working in computing for over 20 years. Before it had become anything like a reality, it had been something that had been driving a certain, particularly, probably psychedelically influenced crowd of people who were working in computing as the reason, or a reason, that computers were at all useful. Well, I wasn't going to browbeat all of my other friends into accepting the reality of a web, which was still really tiny, so I devised a much more crafty scheme. There are regular, I guess you could call them house parties in San Francisco, which are called anon salons, which are actually basically rent parties for people who live down in Soma. And they open up the house and they invite people in to show weird things off, and it's an evening. And I got contacted. I said, oh yeah, let me show something off at the anon salon. And so we actually carted my Spark Station across town and set it up. And I didn't tell anyone who came by that evening that I was showing them the World Wide Web. As a friend came in, I sat them down and said, what's something that interests you? Botany. Click, click, click. Oh, wow! Astronomy. Click, click, click. Cool! Astrology. Click, click, click. Wow, that's great! And every one of them went away seduced by this. So this is January of 1994, and this is sort of before the hoopla had started. But I'd found the trick. And what we saw over the next several years, that this happened to anyone, anywhere, who was anywhere near a computer and a modem. And I started keeping an index, which I've called the Pesci Index, based on the number of URLs that show up in Super Bowl advertisements. And I've been very religious about this. So in 1994, the number was zero. Amazingly, in 1995, there were two. In 1996, every single advertisement had a URL. In 1997, every single advertisement had a URL. In 1998, the figure came down. It's because they stopped running URLs at the bottom of Taco Bell ads because they just made no sense. Because the hipness of being on the web had simply become business as usual. So in 36 months, we saw this complete conflation of the web with the way people work in the world. It was, for all intents, an instantaneous change. So I was watching this as it went along, and in 1997 I stepped back from it. And I said, this is curious. It may be without precedent. And I took a look at it in that light, and I started to wonder if in fact the catalytic genesis of the web wasn't, in fact, some sort of self-organizing principle. There are problems here with what we can know about it, because if I say that there's a self-organizing principle at work here, the self-organizing principle is at a level that's greater than any of us can see as individuals, because we're all embedded in it. So we can only get our own view of things. And it's difficult to step out. But when you step out, you see something that looks pretty doggone catalytic. And the response to each individual in that catalytic process, the reason that the web was so powerful and immediate, is because it seduced everyone as an individual. We all got hooked on the internet's crack. And if I were a meta-organism and I were going to reorganize my internal content or organize my internal content, I'd find some way of doing it that wouldn't require forcing the parts into order, but that would seduce them, that would encourage them, that would lull them into some sort of greater unity. And I saw this and I said, okay, maybe, just possibly, this is the same footprint in the sand that Robinson Crusoe saw on the beach. The thing that let him know that someone else or something else was alive out there. And we can't know necessarily who or what is making that footprint. But I argue that that footprint is an artifact that tells us that there's something that is transhuman or metahuman going on here. And that, in fact, as much as we think that human culture is the raison d'etre of what's going on planet Earth, in fact, perhaps the game got a little broader. And it meshed well with an idea that I'd encountered in my youth, which was the idea of the noosphere from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. To go into that briefly, he was a Jesuit and a paleontologist, and he saw no contradiction between them. And he saw the unfolding history of the planet as a history of organizations, and these organizations occurred in two levels simultaneously. There were organizations and accumulations of size, that is order, and accumulations of interiority or organization. So that organisms passed from a single level stage to a multicellular stage. So that's a size issue. And then as things got further, that internal organization would complexify. In other words, rather than the simple organization of cells that you might see in an organism like a hydra, you might start to see the formation of internal structures such as organs. After that passed for a while, you'd then see further levels of organization into a nervous system, which is a complexifying of the organism so that the organism becomes, in a whole sense, conscious of its environment. And following this line, Teilhard said, well, human beings who have arguably the most advanced consciousness on the planet, that their role in being self-reflective is that they allow a window upon which this process of organization and complexification can view itself. If that statement is true, then what we can see as the next step, what Teilhard proposed, is that there would be an organization and a complexification of the layer of mind that covers the planet. And he called this the noosphere, and noos actually means, I believe it means mind, correct, in Greek. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about this layer of mind that covers the planet. Now, the web is not the noosphere. In the same way that the soul is not the body, they're related, they interact with each other. They aren't the same thing. And you probably can't separate them out and take a look at one or another independently, but one can offer concrete evidence of the other's existence. And so I see this explosiveness of the web happening everywhere instantaneously as being a visible proof or identity that this noospheric entity exists and in fact is working very seductively. It's the seduction of Sophia to in fact bring us into its unity. Let's talk about simulation. Simulation has a relatively long history. Computers, that's what computers do. Computers simulate. Whether it's a spreadsheet doing a simulation or a word processor simulating a page that's being typed. But specifically when we talk about virtual reality, we talk about simulations that are geared toward the human senses. Well, simulation has had two tendencies over the last 20 or 30 years of its development. And one of them has come from above, military simulations. The first simulations were developed in order to improve jet fighter pilots, in order to augment a jet fighter pilot as he's working in a cockpit because he's incredibly informationally overloaded. And all of the basic pioneering work that was done in virtual reality was done on the Defense Department's dime in the 1960s by a man named Ivan Sutherland. So everything that we think of as classically being VR, force feedback, sticking your arm in cyberspace, a head-mounted display, real-time computer graphics, this was all developed 30 years ago. Flash forward about 10 years, and now we have simulation coming up from below in the video game. And as it turns out, most of the people who did pioneering work in virtual reality came not from defense simulation, but from video gaming. So people like Brenda Laurel and Warren Robinette and Jaron Lanier. Jaron Lanier actually made a small fortune off of an Atari video game years before he started working in virtual reality. But these machines were facile enough, they opened enough of a window that the potentiality of the medium to simulate could be exposed. And at this point, with the kind of video games that you can go into a Toys R Us and buy, there's very little difference between a defense simulation engine and a Nintendo 64. They've started to converge. A third track. During the brief period that I was at MIT, I somehow lucked into a salon that was held regularly on Saturday nights in Cambridgeport, which is just outside the bounds of MIT, where a certain very hackerly class of people would get together and talk about new ideas. And it turned out that these salons were held at the house of one person named K. Eric Drexler. And these salons were talking about a set of ideas about making machines that were so small, they were literally made out of molecular components. And they were called nanotechnology, which was an idea that Marvin Minsky had begun to talk about, I believe, in the 1970s, and that Drexler saw and just ran with. And the idea was that the normal physical processes of the world were becoming finer and finer grained with respect to human control over them. And that at some point it would be possible to really assemble reality bit by bit, both literally and figuratively, and to make machines that were of any possible construction at any possible scale. In 1982, he wrote a book called The Engines of Creation, but that book wasn't published until 4 years later. There's a small story there. He wrote the book, and he printed 12 copies, which went out to friends for 48 hours for review. It went out to one of my friends, and I got on my knees, and I begged. And for 12 hours, I read the first draft of The Engines of Creation from cover to cover. The book that was published by some big New York publishing house is not the book he wrote, because the book he wrote could not be published. Because the book he wrote spent chapters plumbing the depths of the possibilities of a technology that could reasonably be used to reanimate the dead. And this is a subject that is not covered in any length or any detail in the published version of it. It's not covered in any length or any detail in the published version of The Engines of Creation because it's just too flipped out for the public to read. But if you talk to a nanotechnologist, perhaps quietly and in a corner because they're all trying to get corporate backing these days, they will agree that this is the case. So there's a drive to control the physical universe at the molecular level from below, that form of nanotechnology. But then we also see the countervailing trend from above, which is the drive to understand biology at the molecular level and understanding the machinery of the cell at its very sort of finest granularity and be able to harness the processes and the sub-processes in the cell such that there is, at a functional level, very little difference between an understanding of the machinery of nature and the creation of the actual machines, ourselves, out of the whole cloth. It turns out that the lines between simulation and nanotechnology converged a lot quicker than anyone had thought. In 1993, a master's student at the University of North Carolina came up with a device that he called the nanomanipulator. The nanomanipulator combines a scanning, tunneling electron microscope, which in shorthand is an STM, which is nothing more than a pin with an extremely sharp point and a small electric charge. They're actually quite easy to make. Well, quite hard to make well, but they're quite easy to make. And this tip and the electric charge on it can be used to move individual atoms around. Well, they also then took the specialty of UNC, which is a thing